at the meeting.
And I learned a tremendous amount each time I listen, in terms of what I should have followed up on and what I do.
Oh.
Learning experience all the time. Okay. The women, the brigade,
was sent back to the headquarters at Penn Gully Building, and we asked them to remain there, you know, in case any further trouble broke out, to remain organized for action. And in going back, a whole group of women and their red berets and so on, nobody really noticed it. Just five of us slipped out, and I and another had been my five lieutenants. And four or five lieutenants. I don't know how many I had with me then. And we walked around and went down in front of the plant four gates, because naturally I was and I just said to the lieutenants, let's just check and see if anything's amiss anywhere else. And we walked down there, and even until we got down there, they didn't know what was happening. And then, of course, it was quite obvious. And they were throwing scabs out of the plant, and there was some fisticuffs going on, and they were trying to barricade, and they were separating people. It was a holy confusion. And at that juncture, Kermit and a couple of other guys at the main gate just yelled out, "Don't let anybody through that gate. We've got a hell of a mess," or something. They told us, you know, several of them who recognized us women. And so we strung ourselves across the gate, and I sent one of the, I knew by now that the plant police and everybody was going to know what had happened, so I sent one of the women to call the brigade from the Penn Gully Building back down again.
Was there anyone else outside besides the few of you from the brigade? Were there other men who were in on the plan who were also outside there?
Yeah. No, I think they arrived shortly after. And there was a sound car that was supposed to have been stationed, I'm pulling this out of my goddamn noodle, somewhere up on Bluff or 3rd Avenue or Bluff Street or something, just in readiness, but out of sight of anybody's consideration. And I think that later that came down. But at the time, when we first arrived there, there was nobody there. Because, you know, that was to be left free. And so we strung ourselves across the gate. We just at first, we weren't even clasping. We were just standing there watching in both directions, because we knew the word was going to be out, and both ends they were going to start coming. And we sent the other woman to the brigade. And that's shortly after that. I don't even know if she got a chance to get back from the telephone. Shortly after that, the police came marching down from the, was it Glenwood or Crisley? Down Chevrolet Avenue. And
the city police.
The city police apparently had gone back to their station, back to their headquarters, and had been immediately sent out again, because the company obviously had sent word for them. No, no, not at that point. They were nowhere to be seen, nowhere in the area. I think there were the whole crew of the plant police and the Flint police were involved. And so we strung ourselves across the gate, and they told us to aside we're going in. And that's when we stopped, and we persuaded, and we talked, and we pleaded. And we were talking to the captain of the police and to the officers, too. And we knew that we had a certain amount of appeal to them, because they did have uncles or cousins or brothers working inside the plant, and they'd been laid off, and they'd been abused, and the speed up was something that everybody in the city of working class origin knew about. So there was a slight tendency to answer our arguments and to talk with us, and finally we exhausted that. We said such things as, if you were working in this plant, wouldn't you expect your wife to be out here protecting your health, your life, your family, and your job? And they at first answered us. And then finally, I think somewhere along the line, I remember that the whole Flint police force was about 75, and it seemed to me that the whole force was there. I can't tell you that. Finally, it dawned on them. They said verbally, "Well, we've got a job to do. This is our job. And aside, just stand aside. And this is when they started pushing, and then we linked arms and stood across the gate, and they just, and then we just said, over our dead bodies, you go in here. Over our dead bodies. And we were very determined. Well, naturally, we couldn't have held out against them. They could have shoved and ruffled us all up or clubbed us or whatever. I don't know. But at that point is when the brigade rounded the avenue and came marching down. And they had the American flag flying at its head, you know, and they were singing solidarity and those red berets bobbing like that. And they reached that scene just in time. And so I said, set up the picket lines in front of the gate. Well, here again was a whole number of women. And the, then the sound car rounded and men started arriving on the scene. And the men and women began to set up the picket line like this. And then, of course, I climbed up in the sound car and started giving directions then to my women and to the men.
Now, at this point, the five of you were in front of the gate and then the pickets arrived. Did the police retreat or were they between those of you in front of the gate and the pickets? Or did they pull back?
The women came down. The police were in file. They were in formation and they'd broken out of formation a little bit. And when they came down, it seemed that the women went on both sides of the police like this and came to the gate, and I said, set up the picket lines, and they started at this end like this. And this is where the police, again, would have had to charge into the women. And by this time, the men started coming, and there was no battle then. And I don't know what happened to those police.
Well, in other words, the women first, in effect, surrounded the police with the picket line. They started picking around the police.
No, they came on both sides of them down like this, and then we started an oval that came over in front of the gate and right in front of us. No, they didn't surround the police with that picket line, but when they came down, they saw what was happening, and they sort of ran the last few steps because they realized this was, you know, the whole police were there, and there was only five of us strung against across the gate.
Yeah, and, but at that point, when you locked arms, was this done as an automatic response, or did you give an order?
I don't know. That was the traditional thing that you... We didn't lock arms because you hung on to each other by the hands like that, because I know we were practically digging nails. It's clenching our fists. I don't think I had to give the order. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And then how many of the women from the brigade...
At full contingent, it was up at Plant 9.
Mm, so it was almost 50 again.
Yeah, 40 or 50 women. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, by this, were you getting any communication from inside? Did you know at all how they were progressing inside at that point?
No. Then after we had the sound car, we had the picket lines, the men came, then, of course, the radio announcements, and then we had all kinds of people down there. And we knew then, because then men climbed over the fence and tried to get in the plant. I think that Walter Reuther, who was in town at the day, got in the plant, and some of the others. And then, of course, we knew what was going on in there. Then we got sure. We had got full information from men coming and going until about 6 o'clock, I guess, when it started turning dark. Maybe it was a couple of hours. I don't even know when that damn battle, what time of day, but about in the evening, about dusk, shortly after we were on the picket lines down there, martial law was declared for the whole area.
But did you...
And all picket lines were dispersed.
It was affected. Wasn't there a period where Kermit then discovered that he only had like 35 men or something? He was hoping he was going to have several hundred?
Yes.
Were you aware of... No.
I was not aware of that. There was no time for communication. Because the plant gate was like this, and then there were steps that were going up like that, and you went into this huge, great big place. And I didn't hear that until maybe it was even after the strike, you know, after he evacuated. Because
so
I didn't see him again.
In other words, your role was to defend.
That's right. No, I did. No, we got messages out. That's right. And I did hear through the messages that he sent out that he had difficulties or something like that. And, of course, we knew when they turned off the heat, the men had to bang on the pipes, and he sent messages out then. Because under military law, we were able to send women in with the food, convoys of food for the men in there. That was agreed with the governor. And so the only recourse that the company had then was to turn off the heat. And those plants in February are bitter cold. And
was Colonel Johnson inside also? Was he in on the takeover
as well? I don't think he was a sit-downer. Wait a minute. My God, how could I have forgotten that? He must have been a sit-downer. I don't know.
Now, once the militia cordoned off the area, it got dark and it was clear that the...
No. Carol Johnson was a first shift worker. Yes, he was a sit-downer. Because he was in on it, I think, at the very last minute Kermit told him.
Mm.
Stay around.
He wasn't aware of the plan ahead of time.
No. Not very many people were. Only about 5 or 6 people.
Mm.
And, of course, he was a completely trusted person. But he didn't get a chance to, you know, to talk to these people.
Mm-hmm.
He just couldn't possibly. And this was top secret.
Yeah.
I think he told his dad there's going to be some action, stick around.
Mm.
And that was probably it.
Because if I recall from the fine book, what happened was it would be about the time of the shortly after the shift change that the sit down began.
Mm-hmm.
Because Kermit and some of the others hid in the bathroom during the shift change so that they had people from both shifts then to draw on for the takeover.
Yeah, that was where they were to meet and coordinate their
mm-hmm.
plans. Yeah, and that's right. Mm-hmm.
Now then, once all the picketing began, the police. Retreated
somehow. Mm-hmm, I guess so. I don't remember the police anymore.
And did the picketing continue and then the militia came in, or actually it was felt that you succeeded and the picketing dropped down?
Oh, no. You never left that gate. My God, no. because we knew they had an arsenal. We knew that they had a stockpiling of arms up there. Some of them knew about it. In the personnel building. And you never left that gate. My God, they had paid agents and paid gunmen, and you had the Workers' Alliance, and you had the Black Legion. The Black Legion was a military organization that would stop at nothing. So you never left the gate. And then when martial law was declared, the young soldiers came with their bayoneted guns and then just asked the pickets to leave, and the Union leaders came down to make it all kosher that this was agreed upon, and please leave. And some of us tried to get in even after that into the compound to get some messages in, at last-minute messages. And we faced those young militiamen. I think that they were 16 or 17 years old, and they'd never pointed a gun at a person in their lives. And those were some of the most dangerous people to come up against because their fingers were actually trembling on the trigger. So we decided that wouldn't be the better course of judgment to talk them. You know, we tried wheedling and doing all kinds of things with police and others of authority, but we decided that was no time, even though they were young, and we could talk like mothers to them, there was no time to talk to them.
So at that point, everyone withdrew and the whole place was cordoned off by the military.
Yes, yeah.
Now, then during the next...
Martial law was declared.
11 days, basically, What was the role then of the brigade, and of the martial law declared, and there was no more action outside of the plan? What did the role then become?
Well, the concentration then was we had bigger and better picket lines in Fisher Number 1 to let the world know that, you see, Fisher 2 was included in the martial law because that was down the street across from Chevrolet. That was in the martial law area. We didn't have any problems, any worry about that. So we concentrated on bigger and bigger and better demonstrations at Fisher 1 to make it look like mass picketing and all kinds of stories that would go out on over the Union bulletins and papers. And then there were also the other plants, you know, that had sat down and were still having difficulties and so on. That's about it.
What was the feeling when...
And, of course, everybody was waiting at their radios and for their papers on the negotiations in Detroit.
Well, what was the feeling when it was clear that they had managed to take full over and the militia came in? Did you think you were at the moment of victory, or when the militia came in, did you feel that was going to be the end?
Well, workers were torn, pro and con. There were a lot of anarchists that thought, well, we'd sold out completely. The governor had sold, they talked us into this, and our leaders had sold out by even going along. Why didn't we have pitched battle with the militia? But they were in a minority. I think that the workers at the time had confidence in Governor Murphy. And very often at that level of understanding and so on, they thought and spoke in terms of leaders so often, the rank and file did. And this man is our friend, or this man is our enemy. And I think they had great confidence in him. And then, of course, John L. Lewis was carrying on his histrionics in favor of the plant for Chevrolet workers, because he knew what that meant to General Motors. Everybody by that time in the CIO knew this was the only motor plant for all of Chevrolet. This we got him right, you know, in the guts. And John L. Lewis then was going into a marvelous stage of probably the best role he ever played. Ever. Yeah, he did get the flu, didn't he?
I think towards the very end of the negotiations.
That's right.
Very touch and go. They had to go to the hotel room and he was in bed.
I remember that. I should review that. The Fine had wrote about that, too. I should review that book again. You know, I'm going to try to get time before our next interview to read that book, because when I read it before, it brought a lot of things into focus and a lot of things back to my mind that I hadn't even thought was dormant. Yes. Now, I bought this book, 1695, for this, because I thought, Victor being in there, as I say, he was back and forth between Detroit and Flint, that perhaps something would come out of this. And I was terribly disappointed. What a bad investment that was. God, I should have gotten it from some library first. It was all the way through, even his own brother, Roy. Of course, Victor was always alert and not so ready to salute every time Walter spoke, because they traveled through Europe together and to Russia together, and they were very, very close. But his own brother, Roy, didn't get due credit in this book. And I can't conceive of it. I can, but he must be an old man that forgot a lot of things, or I don't know. It sounds like such a haphazard, garbled thing. But I got that especially because I thought maybe there'd be some things that would come out of my mind for you, this interview with you.
Once the militia came in and the negotiations were going on, though, did you and, say, the Socialist Party group also have faith that Murphy was going to do right by the workers and that it was going to be?
No. We were just hoping day by day.
How long did you think that plant for could be held?
Murphy was a judge before, you know, and that usually means a person who's impartial. And so that's why we were hoping day by day. When we heard about his family background, and there was talk about it during those days, we didn't know as much as afterward, but, you know, the Irish revolutionaries and so on, we sort of hoped that he would be on our side. But after it was gone this far, there was nothing that we could have done in Flint anyway. We had done everything possible. And after it was under martial law, there was nothing that we could do. It had to be in the negotiations or the pressure.
The militia laws, you basically felt it was out of your hands now, that there was nothing more that the workers could do.
As far as Chevrolet was concerned, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Fisher, we just wanted to maintain the impression, don't you touch this, because the martial law was not declared for that area out there.
Now, there wasn't... The workers inside the sit-downers were able to communicate and get food from the outside without much difficulty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We had trucks going in the back of the plant, and there was an agreement. Mm-hmm. They were let through by the guard.
So then it was just a matter of waiting it out for the next.
It wasn't. It was more than a matter of waiting out for the guys inside, because some of them, from turning off the heat, got pneumonia, got very, very sick. And they sent in some doctor. Can't remember who the first doctor was. And my God, he said that they were in very serious danger, and sent them all home. You know, a great number of them, several of them anyway, very keen people. And this happened, and then the union got suspicious as that something was wrong, and they sent in a union doctor, Dr. Probert. Dr. Probert went in there and gave them some medicine and cured them, and said that was, there was no reason for the men to get so alarmed, and that it was such a contagious thing, and that they should not have been sent home. So they had that problem inside the plant. They also had the problem of, we had a way of getting through the brigade. Wives could send us letters. By the way, I got one of those letters when I was in Chicago. And then the men inside could write to their wives by sending it to the brigade, and we'd see that their wives got it. And one of them, by a name of Clifton Dean, wrote to his wife and said, God bless those wonderful women, the brigade. They will see that you get this. And she was, Emily Dean was a member of the brigade, too. Yeah, and so the wives could get letters into their husbands, and the husbands could get letters into their wives. We thought that would make the men feel better, because these men, if you read some of the letters that came out of that plan, were terribly concerned about how were their wives getting along day by day for fuel and for food.
How were they?
Well, the union could give them little piddling sums, maybe enough to get food for 1 or 2 days. They could help out in some cases, and some cases relatives would send over dishes of food or help out, or by hook and by crook is the way they were getting along.
The union didn't have an ongoing storehouse to distribute food and clothes.
No. Not in the sense that you know of it today. Farmers would come in and contribute things, but it usually went through the strike kitchen. And the money that was sent in through the CIO, a fledgling organization, came primarily from the United Mine Workers, who assessed themselves, and it had to cover the whole auto worker strike nationally. So it was a very small amount of money, but it was enough to keep body and soul together. That's the way they were existing, and these letters reflected such terrible anguish on the part of some of the men sitting down in the plant, knowing they had to do their duty, but how was the sick baby at home, the one that had the measles and so on. And then the wives would, we talked to the wives, many of them, and told them, be sure that you keep your letters optimistic and keep their spirits up, and they'd send in some beautiful letters. One man wrote, I'll be here until hell freezes over, unless they recognize the union. And another wife would write in and hold the post, we're holding it out here, you hold it inside. Beautiful letters. So the inside it was not easy. Finally they got blankets into them in there. They had no upholstered conditions or anything like that. Chevrolet, this was a motor assembly plant, all steel and conveyor belts, and this huge, huge thing that even if you did get a little drum of fire going somewhere, couldn't possibly heat any area. You just have to get up close to it.
How long did they keep the heat off then?
Until the, I think probably it would be a matter of 24 hours or 30 hours, something like that, until the Kermit gave the orders for the men to disperse at all ends of that plant and start banging on pipes and whatever they could. And General Motors got terrified. This is a very big investment, you know, for a corporation, and thought that perhaps all of their lines and their conveyor systems and everything else were being smashed inside. And then I think the union negotiated, get the heat back on in there if you don't want your plant wrecked, you know. So it was not easy for the men in there, 14 days. 11 days? 14? How many days were they in there? I've forgotten.
Well, they took it over on February 1st.
11 days then. Evacuation was on the 11th, I think.
What was there the kind of community that grew up there similar to Ethic there was committees that patrolled the plans and committees that took care of this and that took care of that.
Inside? Mm-hmm. Yeah, they didn't have the same number of men, and they didn't have the kind of service that they got from the outside. But they did. They had a little band that was supposed to cheer people up. What kind of little band did they have? I remember it vaguely now. Somebody mentioned they called them Hillbilly Band. They probably, somebody had a guitar or something in there, sent in, gotten in something. I don't know. And they had, they did. They had committees. Boy, I have forgotten that. I've heard all the discussion of what went on inside that plant, too. And they had, the main thing was boredom. They had people up on pedestals practicing to be public speakers, and they were singing. They had a chorus in there organized. And I don't remember all of the groups, but they had, they had to have relief from watch places in the plant at all times because they were not sure of what might happen. And the plant was a very, very big place, so men were spread out quite a bit of the time. I have to give that more thought. You can pull some more out of my head on that. Because I wasn't inside the plant. I was inside a Fisher to visit, and I got a view of how it was organized and set up, but not inside of Chevrolet.
But they were really quite isolated compared to
Oh, yes. And I think that they boiled down to less than 100 men in that huge, great, big plant that employed, that whole Chevrolet division employed 14,100 men holding a plant. At any time, they could have taken it, if they hadn't been for the circumstances as they developed.
At some point, everyone was fairly confident that they'd done everything they could do, and now negotiations were hopefully being resolved.
Yes.
Now, when the negotiations...
And, of course, when it was wired across the country that Chevrolet Plant 4 went down, the only motor-producing plant for Chevrolet, the morale of the other Chevrolet, the other General Motors plants went way up. And then the whole spirit of unionism just boom like that, not only in Flint, but in Detroit and all over. It was everybody understood that was in General Motors what this meant, and they understood in Ford and in Chrysler too. They understood what it meant very early.
So at this point, then again, it was concentrating back at Fisher One, and then kind of seeing a liaison between the men inside at Ford and the wives and the community outside.
Mm-hmm.
Waiting to see what was going to happen.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So between the time of the actual takeover and the completion of the negotiations, there was no other real activity or action or interest.
Around the Chevrolet area, no. No, not in that whole area that was cordoned off. Now, another thing we were terribly concerned about is that at this juncture, if capitalism hadn't been so competitive, and if Ford and Chrysler had united, they could have broken us too. United in along with General Motors, in support of General Motors. But they didn't. They went on, Ford went on throwing out Fords, which was taking the market away from Chevrolet every day. And that was the main competitive car between the two corporations, Ford and Chevrolet. And that was a factor that was in our favor. We were very, very pleased about that. Because if they had only united with General Motors, it could have been very bad for us.
Do you recall, did Kermit talk about it, did you hear from the other diplomats? Was there a need to contain, for instance, the anger of the men in charge that there wasn't sabotage, or were they naturally even thinking those terms?
I'll tell you how they did think. They thought these were their jobs. They didn't want to sabotage it. They wanted that machinery left intact. So as quickly as the strike was over, and they were hoping that their action would bring it to a quick culmination, that they could go back to work on those machines and without any trouble of repair or anything else. Now, the one interesting thing that happened in Chevrolet, and it happened nowhere else that I know of except in Ford, was that a black worker sat down. And there were two black brothers that had had a very, very tough experience in the South. Their homes were taken away from them by being arrested constantly and fined and levied against their property. And they came up to Flint to settle to get a job. And they were both widowers, or at least they didn't have wives, but they had children. So they lived together in a house. One brother worked first shift, the other brother worked second shift in Plant 4 Chevrolet. And they were older men, and they were both not very tall, very small little men, always on the picket line. So that when one brother was inside working, and their children were grown up enough to get meals and things like that, when one brother was inside working, the other brother would be on the picket lines wherever he was needed, you know, at Fisher, wherever, at the Union Hall. And then when that brother had to go in and work the second shift, the other brother was on the line. And these were the Van Zandt, Roscoe and Morris Van Zandt. And when the strike was called, Roscoe Van Zandt sat down. The other brother, even though it was at change of shift, the other brother had to be out with the kids and see that everything was all right. So Roscoe Van Zandt was the only black sit-downer in any area of the General Motors plants that we're aware of, certainly in Flint. There were no black sit-downers in Fisher. There was none in Fisher 2. He was the only one. And this was very, very rare. And when the first night that they were in, he took his food and he went around the corner and sat down to eat it, because blacks and whites did not eat together then. Blacks and whites did not associate together then. Blacks could not even work on machinery or conveyor belts or presses next to whites then. They were only in the sanitation department of Chevrolet and Buick and Fisher. And so therefore, there was never any contact between them, just sweeping and cleaning latrines and so on. And this was a big shock to those southern-born workers. My God, what was he in here for, you know? What was he fighting for? He had the lowest job. He didn't have anything to fight for. Who won his job? And so some of them got up enough nerve. And, of course, Kermit was a socialist, and color didn't mean anything. He introduced each other around, and some of them got up enough nerve to ask him, what were you doing? He said, well, I've got nothing to lose, have I? But you'll never be taken on. If we lose this strike, you'll never get a job anywhere. And he said, but we're not going to lose. We're going to win this strike, aren't we? And they were so stunned. And the first night came along, and there was one old blanket they found somewhere in a superintendent's office or something. And there was no place to sleep for the men, and only this one blanket the first night. And so they took a vote who was going to have it. Now, he was probably one of the older strikers in there, and there was a great big table, a layout table or something, and they voted that he should have the layout table to sleep on and the blanket. Because it was so stunned that this black man would risk everything without ever having the opportunity to get a job anywhere to sit in with him. And as a result of that, inside the plant, he no longer ate separately nor anything else. And little by little, those men inside the plant had a different concept of, you know, the value of a man, a laboring man, as a brother, you know. That they were as much a brother as. Now, the reason that we didn't have any black women in the brigade was, first of all, their husbands didn't have decent jobs. There weren't very many of them employed. And secondly, all of these leaders were Southerners, and they never made blacks feel very comfortable. But Roscoe Van Zandt, they voted that he carry out the American flag upon the evacuation, too.
And did that relationship with him continue then afterwards?
After the strike? Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. They had the black community in the north end. We had two black communities in the south and in the north end of Flint. And the north end was a big area, transient area and so on. And the black community up there had a ceremony to honor him. Now, he was never recognized ever officially by the UAW, which is a sad commentary. Because in the first place, he was only one person. There were many people who played the same role, and they weren't going to show him any consideration because he was black and because there was a lot of prejudice that existed still, you know. And So the black area, the people up there got together and they organized a some kind of a memorial meeting, or not a memorial, an honorary meeting to honor him. And I was invited, and Kermit was invited, and several other leaders were invited of the strike to come up there and give it. It was a testimonial, that's what it was, to give testimony. So when we came in, we were labeled dignitaries, and the dignitary sat up in front. And here was Roscoe Van Zandt. And we all got up and we gave our speeches. And I'm telling you, when I got up at first to speak, it was a wonderful experience for me. And it's something that taught me such a lesson. I love speaking before black, those kind of black audiences. They've changed now. But I started out to tell about the strike and, you know, what we were all in it for. And I said one or two sentences and they yelled out, "Amen!" And then I said a couple more, and I was completely disconcerted. I'd never had this happen to me. And I was interrupted five or six times and trying to get back, you know, and get my thought again. And finally, I got the idea. I like this. I know when it's going over and when it isn't going over. And hallelujah, you had your hallelujah. Sister, you speak the truth, you know. And it was one of the nicest meetings that I have ever, ever had in my whole life. And it was such a strange thing for me to go to this all-black meeting and to be labeled Dignitary Brigadier.
Dignitary.
I can't think of any.
Was he then, did he become active in the locals then after the strike?
Yeah, he was always a union man, yes. Of course, they didn't get a chance until World War II, certainly after, to organize, you know, under the FEPC. But yes, he was one of those that were in the leadership of that too, organizing for that, the black workers to be upgraded to other jobs in the factory.
When they went back in after the strike, did it affect the consciousness of more of the workers than those who sat down when they all went back to them?
No, I don't think so. Not appreciably.
Mm-hmm.
They had learned a great deal about brotherhood. And I think among some of the people who had actually participated in the more harrowing events of the strike, you know, facing danger and so on, I think probably they had a much more tolerant attitude. But you don't change people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, you know, overnight when they come out of a deep South environment.
What was the response of, the strikers and union people there when they evacuated, weren't there? And didn't the parade form from the evacuation group when they evacuated?
Oh, my God. When they evacuated, and there was planned that they would evacuate first out at Fisher 1. And so all of the people, the Fisher wives and all the people that were out in that end of town, watched them come out of the plants. And those guys were in there 44 days, and some of them had beards. Watched them come out of the plants and start parading up Saginaw Street, and then they came over to the Chevrolet division. And there they came down Chevrolet Avenue, and out the evacuees came, and there were sound cars and screaming and yelling and hooting and howling. And I couldn't even get up to greet Kermit when he came out of the shop. And finally, I did. I guess I got crushed in with a whole group of people. And then up to Fisher 2, and then through the main streets of the city of Flint, and it was all night long.
What was the reaction of the community to the state parade?
What community? I thought the whole community was... Well, of course, the Workers' Alliance people. They were terribly bitter, and I suppose they had feelings of wonder if there's going to be reprisals against us, because the division between worker and worker that had been those that had been active in the Workers' Alliance and the UAW. The people who had were around the labor movement, and that means all of the transit workers and the department store clerks and all of those who had started organizational drives. They just filled up the whole city.
They all joined the parade.
Yes, of course. And they paraded through sections of town all night long, and in beer gardens and. Well, all night long, the city was just celebrating.
Was there a joining of among those who had held back and hadn't supported the union, but
yes,
who had been sort of watching? Did they join?
Oh, good God, yes. Once there's a victory, you don't know how many people said, I was with you. I was down there. You don't know how many people we had sitting inside those plants afterward either. Emil Macy said when the BBC man was up there, he said, listen, if all the people today who said that they were sitting in holding that plant and holding the fort and so on, if they'd actually been there, you know, we wouldn't have had any trouble at all. We wouldn't have had any battles with anybody. But he said it's a mark of tribute to the union that that they like to say these things. But it's true, yes. And all of those who were frightened and some of those who were even against the union knew that now this was the power and the force, and it didn't take long.
What was the feeling about the agreement itself?
About the agreement itself? My God, I think they must have thought that it was in the second issue of the Bible at the time. They didn't go into, they didn't care. They were recognized. And they were recognized by the very corporation that said, never will we recognize any organization having a say in the way we run this business, hire our men, discharge them, or anything else about the plant. We'll never recognize, you know, and that was over and over and over again in the press and in the literature, radio. And I think that they just thought it was the greatest, one of the greatest things in the world. We were recognized as having something to say.
There was just 6 months. Period during which they could organize, but it wasn't out and out recognition yet. That didn't seem to, that was viewed as being a way for the company to say, hey. In other words,
that was, that's right. It was a union victory. It was recognition as far as they were concerned. The very fact that we had the right to organize in their plans. Remember, if you showed up with a button, you showed up without your job. And you got beaten up and you couldn't talk union to the guy next to you in the shop. That was recognition. The very fact that we could wear a union button in there, that we could organize. And of course. And they weren't picky at all because we never, we knew inside how many people we actually had. And it was such a small number, such a small percentage of workers.
But there wasn't, very often after a strike and an agreement, there's always a faction that feels that the leadership is sold out and is unhappy with the agreement. There wasn't that kind of feeling among groups of people about the agreement?
Well, about the agreement. They were super militants, but most of the people had just come up to this stage of even unionism. And the majority of the people certainly didn't feel that anybody had sold out. They really felt that we had accomplished more than they expected when they started out. That's the majority.